Thank you very much, Sherry, and thanks so much for putting together all the good work that's going on and represented here in the conference. I have a disclosure. I don't know of anything that, other than my normal marital life, that would constitute a disclosure, but I'm going to be joined by my colleague, Eileen Jacobs, who's an attorney with California Rural Legal Assistance, and for, I guess, 24 years worked as an attorney with CRLA, and she is Director of Litigation Advocacy and Training, and she's going to present the first few minutes of our talk. Eileen?
Thank you, Don. I suppose my disclosure should be that I'm a lawyer. So which one do I press here?
The arrow.
The arrow. Okay. Thank you. So California Rural Legal Assistance is a statewide legal services program that provides free legal representation to farm workers and other rural poor and minorities throughout rural California. Our southernmost office is in El Centro, right on the Mexican border, and our northernmost offices are in Marysville and Santa Rosa, north of San Francisco and Sacramento, for those of you who are not familiar with the geography. We have both a rural fair housing center and an agricultural health and housing project that we operate throughout our 22 offices in California. And a great part of what I have done and what our Rural Fair Housing Center and our Agricultural Worker Health and Housing Project has done is to focus on farm worker housing conditions. When I started practicing law longer ago than I've been with California Rural Legal Assistance, I represented homeless people in Washington, D.C., worked on behalf of Mitch Snyder, for those of you who might remember him, and thought that the urban homeless problems were the worst and the most hidden housing or unhousing conditions that I had seen at the time. Since coming to California and working on housing and civil rights issues, I have to say that farmworker housing conditions are the most hidden conditions for low-income populations in this country, and I think farm workers are the most exploited workforce in this country, and grappling with their housing conditions as an advocate trying to improve them is extremely difficult. And what we've discovered is that it's also difficult in the research world and in the public health world. The housing conditions are not necessarily seen as a public health issue, and they're not necessarily the subject of a great deal of research. And one of our projects, and what Don is going to talk about today, is a paper that we produced called Unsafe at Home, and Don will tell you more about that. But the idea was to do a literature review to determine whether there was research that existed showing the connections between adverse impacts on physical and mental health of farm workers and their families and their housing conditions. And remarkably, that to me seems like, of course, there are connections between farm worker housing conditions and adverse impacts on mental and physical health, but the literature isn't there. There's a lot of work that's been done on urban health problems, asthma, lead. There isn't a lot of work except for what Don and Tom Markery, who's with us in the back, and others at Wake Forest, Mark Schenker at UC Davis have been looking at more recently. But there's not a lot out there, and so part of what we've tried to do is call for research and research in support of advocacy. The research in support of advocacy, in addition to this paper, includes having researchers and public health professionals work with advocates in order to implement programs that exist to provide decent housing for farm workers and to do the planning that is necessary in order to have farm worker housing that is in good condition developed where we're working in California, but as well throughout the country. Don and I have worked together on cases that California Rural Legal Assistance has brought in support of farm worker housing, enforcing planning requirements that all local jurisdictions in California have, by collaborating to produce studies in support of that advocacy. And two settlements that we're referring to here is Napa and Mendocino counties, resulted from litigation that we brought to enforce planning and land use requirements that jurisdictions have to make sure that there is land available to develop farm worker housing. We were able, through the settlements in that litigation, to produce research papers that the California Institute for Rural Studies was involved in preparing that documented the need. And if we can't document the need, unfortunately, and if we can't document the impact on health, it makes it much more difficult for us to do our advocacy. These pictures are the proverbial pictures worth a thousand words. Many people, I find, have no idea what conditions farm workers actually live in. These appear to be third world country conditions. Well, this is a third world country in San Diego County, California. San Diego County is a fairly wealthy county in California and a fairly wealthy county in the country. And the people who you see in these pictures are depicted by David Bacon. And if any of you are interested in seeing more of his photographs, you can just Google him or go to davidbacon.com. He has taken pictures of many indigenous farm workers and farm workers throughout California. These farm workers are living in caves, in canyons, in San Diego County, just about adjacent to newly developed mini mansions. And they're often harassed by the young people who live in the neighborhoods adjacent to them and threatened with physical violence as well as asked to go back home. These are the conditions they live in. The Invisible Mexicans of Deer Canyon is a film that Don especially recommends, and I recommend to you if you want to see the conditions that farm workers live in. We are talking not only the conditions that you saw in the pictures of San Diego County, but farm workers who live in onion fields in Lancaster, California, out in the open, in the fields, under tarps, if they're lucky, in a car alongside the road next to the onion fields where they're going to be working. They live in worse conditions than that, and that is a constant and very common. So we worked together, a group of which Don is a member and Tom Arcury is a member, to produce a rural justice forum. For California Rural Legal Assistance, it was the first rural justice forum we had, and it was on farm labor health and housing. And as I said, we identified a lack of literature or a gap in the literature that shows the connection between the despicable conditions that farm workers live in and their health and the health of their families and of their communities. And I want to say that when I talk about housing conditions, I'm also talking about community conditions. I'm talking about infrastructure. I'm talking about impotable water. I'm talking about septic systems that, if they exist, they overflow. I'm talking about gas that is delivered through garden hoses. I'm talking about very dangerous and very unhealthy conditions in communities as well as in farm labor camps and individual housing. As I said, the research is lacking. We brought together a group of researchers and advocates and health practitioners in 2008. We asked them to review this paper, Unsafe at Home. Don is one of the authors. Tom Arcury, who's here, was one of the reviewers. We had a day-long seminar in which we discussed steps that needed to be taken in the future and reviewed this paper. It has now been published on CRLA's website. The authors are including Don, Mark Schenker at UC Davis, Ann Moss Joyner, and Alan Parnell, who are at the Cedar Grove Institute for Sustainable Communities in North Carolina. CRLA commissioned it. We have published it on our website. And Don tells me to remind you that you should write down the site because it's not that easy to find on our website. So it's www.crla.org/node/9. You can always send me an email if you can't find it, and I'll send it to you. The idea that we have is to continue on in this effort to have a second Rural Justice Forum to bring together advocates, health practitioners, researchers, to do a call for papers and to make sure that the gap in the research is filled in support of individual advocacy, enforcing decent conditions in farm worker housing, as well as in support of policy advocacy to make funding available for decent farm worker housing and to make enforcement possible for decent farm worker housing. I think we need both a moral and an intellectual compass in support of this work, and I think that public health practitioners can join forces with researchers as well as with farmworker advocates who are trying to improve the conditions in which farmworkers live and to avoid having third world conditions in the wealthiest country in the world. Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Eileen. I'm going to turn now to some of the considerations that went into the paper, as well as some recent findings that I think inform this discussion. In general, I think we're all aware that there are many determinants of population health, individual traits, innate traits, if you will, onto individual behaviors, risk behaviors of all kinds, as well as social, family, and community networks, and reaching out, including living and working conditions, and ultimately global conditions. Within that context, though, if we look at farmworker housing, the factors that really we think have to be taken into account are the poverty status of the population, water quality, heating, cooling, crowding, indoor air pollutants, and so forth. In that context, one of the collaborators that is with our little group, Asa Bradman at UC Berkeley and his collaborators have in the Chamacos cohort been looking at housing conditions. And in their sample of 644 dwellings, these are the kinds of contaminants, if you will, that are presented to farm workers in Salinas, California. Rodents, cockroaches, pesticides stored in the dwelling, water damage, gas stoves without vents, and the list goes on. Conditions that would not be tolerated in the majority community. In addition, there are neighborhood effects, proximate outdoor pollution sources, dumps of all kinds that come to rural areas because wealthy people in Los Angeles don't want to deal with their toxic waste, so they send it to Coalinga, California, where we're having a serious problem of birth defects. And there are other issues as well associated with neighborhoods. And then finally, there are environmental effects. Ambient environmental effects include, for example, the severe heat that we have in the Central Valley of California. When temperatures get over 110 degrees and you have no respite from that at home, that's an issue. And then you go to work the next day, and you're still at risk. As Eileen mentioned, we did produce this paper. And some of the conclusions that I think are worth reflecting on are that in the past 25 years, we see a steep decline in employer-provided labor camps throughout the nation. Most workers reside now in private market housing as renters. There are significant regional differences. For example, in North Carolina, as Tom and others have pointed out to us, most workers live in labor camps today. But in California, less than 3% of workers reside in labor camp housing. There's less regulatory oversight of where workers live as a result, because if workers live in private rental housing, they're not subject to the OSHA standards. There's a substantial recent literature in which Tom and Asa Bradman and Rich Fenske in Washington and others are looking in very careful and I think exacting detail at exposures that are faced by folks who live in these kind of conditions. But there are very few studies that look simultaneously at housing conditions and worker health in the same population. And this was identified in an excellent review article by Jacobs in 2009, Environmental Health Perspectives. And it applies to the farm labor research as well. I want to turn now to some work in California just to give you a sense of some of the things that we see. I'm not going to go through a great deal of detail in this. The literature is available and referred to in the paper that Eileen elucidated. These are folks picking wine grapes, an industry that brings in about $42 billion a year nationally. We went to, thanks to the litigation brought by Eileen and her staff, to Napa and Mendocino counties to respond to the desire of the counties to actually look at the need for farm labor housing in those counties. We did basically cluster sampling, looking at a vineyard and orchard farm operators, and then other types of farms, and finally farm labor contractors. We did a stratified random sample of the vineyard and orchard farm operators and simple random samples of the other two groups. We did telephone interviews of the employers and in-person interviews of workers contacted through the employer. We did 258 direct hire farm or FLC, farm labor contractor employee interviews, about a 47% response rate. Hard to track down some of them, but we did. We got about a one-quarter sample of all the farm operators in both counties. We did 394 in-person worker interviews. The response rate varied. About 90% of the workers we actually contacted cooperated. Napa County workers were interviewed on-site at the workplace or, in some instances, in their homes. Worker residents were found in nearly every Napa County community, as well as in communities in Lake, San Joaquin, Solano, Sonoma, and Yolo counties. And the point here is that many workers don't live in the county where they work. They actually are transported in through raiteros or other systems that are informal transportation networks, and often workers have to pay in cash a substantial fee just for the right to have that job to that particular raitero. This is a sort of overview summary of what we did in the two counties. The most important things to look at are, for example, not a single U.S.-born worker in both counties, not even one in these random samples. We couldn't find one. Predominantly men. We asked folks about their immigration status, and in Napa County, about 60% of the folks said they were undocumented. We don't know if that's an accurate reflection of the true situation, but at least the folks who said they were undocumented very likely were. On the other hand, about 2007, we went to Mendocino. We found about a little over a quarter of the folks would not respond to our question, and that was because of the raid that happened in Mendota, where the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement folks, went into people's homes, they busted down doors, they took people out, we think they kidnapped them, they don't see it that way. 200 folks were taken away. And as a result of that, a panic spread throughout California. And so people are very, very protective now about their immigration status. Nevertheless, 109 folks in Mendocino told us they were undocumented. The important point about this slide is that there is a substantial difference in the income and in the way in which folks use their income between the documented and the undocumented population. So for example, among the documented folks, the rent income as a percent of their median income is about 17%. Among the undocumented, just a little bit bigger, probably not statistically different, but look at the remittances. 4% among the undocumented folk as compared to their median income, but 38%. Folks are sending back much more money home than they are paying for rent. And that leads to a kind of a compromise where people are willing to put up with certain kinds of conditions in order to support their families at home. And this is a factor that's not really thought very much about in folks who do housing policy, for example. Also look at the non-relatives sharing dwellings. 65% of the undocumented folk were sharing dwellings with non-relatives. 5+ persons unrelated sharing the room. 34% among the undocumented population. This is one of the origins of the severely crowded situations that we find. 44% of the undocumented living in severely crowded situations. And then finally, using a paid raitero for transportation, a little over a quarter of the folks who were undocumented told us they were doing that. The recommendations that emerged from both farm operators and from farm workers were actually coincident, absolutely coincident. They both thought the same needs were essential. One, safe and affordable housing for workers who are unaccompanied by any family member. Very important point. Second, urgent need for housing for workers employed fewer than 6 months. There should be fewer restrictions on eligibility for housing, such as immigration status or family only. In the review we did of the farm labor housing programs of USDA, we learned that USDA programs serve only folks who are documented, in other words, either citizen or green card. In addition, only serve folks that are a nuclear family. What about the majority of farm workers in the U.S. who are unaccompanied, neglected entirely? Housing should be co-located with services, and everybody agreed on that. So this is what the folks that we interviewed said, both farmers and workers. And we're a long way from meeting those objectives in terms of policy. I want to briefly talk about some of the work we did a little over 10 years ago now. It was the statewide cross-sectional household survey in 7 representative communities. Randomly selected eligible workers residing in randomly selected dwellings. Eligibility was limited to persons age 18 or older who had been employed as a hired worker on a farm during the prior 12 months. Participation rate was 83% in the random knock on the door. These are the papers that you can read to find out more detail. The point about this is this was an actual household survey. In other words, a housing survey that looked at both housing and looked at health. These are the 7 communities, Arbuckle in the north, Calistoga, Firebaugh, and Cutler in the San Joaquin Valley, Gonzales in the central coast, Vista in the southern coast, and Mecca in the inland desert. This is a photograph taken in Mecca of really nice, recently developed housing. It looks very promising and very encouraging. But if you get in an airplane and fly over Mecca, you see something else. And this is the rest of the town, where there are front houses that face the street, and behind nearly all of them, there are all kinds of structures and trailers. We call those back houses. This is a photograph I took behind a barbed wire fence of some of the back houses, an abandoned trailer, which is now used as rental housing for workers, structures built over here. Behind there, there was a big awning that served as a shade for people who were living out in the open. We find that overall, statewide, roughly 1 out of 9 dwellings occupied by farm workers is one of these kinds of non-standard dwellings. Not recognized by the postal authorities, not recognized by the county tax authorities. As far as all the official authorities think, these places don't exist. But 1 out of 9 households where workers live is that situation. We find that about 40% of the men and about 30% of the women share their dwelling with unrelated persons. 42% of the men and 17% of the women in our sample were unaccompanied. Surprisingly, quite a number of the men live alone, living in a trailer or living in their vehicle or living under a tree somewhere. Quite a number. The number of dwellings that lacked complete plumbing and lacked complete kitchens was more prevalent among the men. The women won't put up with that kind of stuff. Self-reported health conditions in the prior 12 months by resident status, male hired farm workers. And here we compare the folks who live with unrelated persons, okay, in the green, and the persons who do not live with unrelated persons, just reporting things like earaches and nervios, extreme agitation. Clear association with sharing your dwelling, and we can go on to more detail on that, but you'll have to look at the papers to find out more if you're interested. Some workers, especially unaccompanied recent migrants, consciously save on housing to send more remittances home to their family. That's an important conclusion that came out of this work. Many workers reside in crowded substandard private market housing today, not subject to regulation of any kind other than local housing ordinances. There is little regulatory oversight, and this is a serious issue. For example, in the Napa survey, we found in an adjacent city, an adjacent county, an entire motel in which the first room, a 2-room dwelling, was occupied by 10 men. Think about that. 1 toilet, 10 men. The next room, 8 men, single room. Next room, 8 men, single room, okay? This is not a labor camp. It's not registered or licensed. It's just a normal motel. When we talked to the workers, they said, we came up here from wherever and said we needed a place to live. And we talked to folks and they said, oh, there's that place over in that other county where you can get a pretty good rate. And so people living there were paying less than they would pay in a government-sponsored camp. That's what's going on. We need new studies to simultaneously measure exposures and the health of residents in the same population, and we need to supplement that with household economic information. That's the challenge for you. I hope you step up to the plate and help us. Thank you.
Services and assistance. Have you done or know of
Sure.
The minors are immigrant minors are here.
Yeah.
Thank
you. That's a very perceptive question. The reason we limited it to persons 18 and older is that we wanted to do physical exams, and we did not want to get into all the problems of doing physical exams on children, particularly if there was unclarity about whether there was an adult present. I mean, it gets pretty messy, as you know. So wanting to do physical exams led us to a difficult conclusion, but we had to do it in order to be able to do what we needed to do, and that is to limit it to 18 and over. However, in every dwelling, we did a complete enumeration of all residents of the dwelling, okay? So in 83% of the cold contact random selected dwellings statewide, we got a complete enumeration. And we found children who were doing farm work. We found unaccompanied children doing farm work, okay? So that's there. The person that you need to track down is Ed Kissam, K-I-S-S-A-M. He did work for us in Immokalee, Florida, looking at exactly that question and wrote a beautiful paper on it. It's available through him. So it's Ed Kissam, K-I-S-S-A-M. So I hope that answers your question.
Hi, Amy Levin from Migrant Clinicians Network. First of all, I just want to applaud the model that you guys put forth with the researchers working with advocates. I can't say how wonderful and important it is. The NIOSH Ag Center RFA just hit the street, and it would be great to have proposals that are specifically looking at translating research to policy. For all you researchers out there, community activists really, really want those partnerships. The second thing is I actually have a question for you is I really thought the differences between your documented and undocumented workers were really interesting. And I'm wondering if you were able to get a feel in terms of what kinds of documentation the folks have and how that influenced their living conditions.
Yes, that's a good question. We did ask in detail whether they had a green card, whether there were other kinds of H-2A, for example, visas. We asked about citizenship, birth in the U.S., and so forth, but there were none of that. So we did ask those details. My view is that the sample size was too small to arrive at any statistically stable conclusions. Obviously, we were limited by resources in terms of what we could do, as is always the case in the research world. And I would love to, you know, like nothing more than to be able to have adequate resources to track down those questions. That was in the Napa and Mendocino studies. In the cause, we did have a large enough sample to be able to do some interesting things. And if you read the papers, particularly the second one in the Journal of, what was it called, Industrial Medicine, American Journal of Industrial Medicine, and I believe it was April of this year, there's a lot of detail about some of that that you might find helpful. So thank you.
And if I might add just not research-based, but something anecdotal in response to that, undocumented workers obviously are more exploitable than U.S. citizen workers or documented workers. And the employers and farm labor contractors know that. So it's easier to put 10 undocumented, unaccompanied workers in a motel room, not have them complain about the conditions, and if they do have them complain, if they do complain about the conditions, throw them out, fire them, and threaten to deport them or have them deported. So I think that anecdotally we see a lot of that, and that can make a big difference in terms of housing conditions. Similar problem with mixed families, and even when there are subsidized housing programs that are available for farm labor, even if they don't ask the citizenship or immigration status of all the occupants in the family, it is still very difficult for mixed families to reside in housing that is in decent, safe, and sanitary condition, subsidized so that they can afford the rent, because they're always afraid of either retaliation for some reason or threats of deportation of some family members. So the restrictions on undocumented workers have a big effect on their housing.
So I'm going to let Carrie make a brief announcement, and then we'll open it up to questions for any of the panelists.
Thank you. Thank you. My name's Carrie Souza. I'm one of the program planners for this section. And I'd want to thank you, first of all, for your continued interest in the occupational health disparities track. But I also just wanted to make a special announcement and to bring your attention to a session that's coming up at 10:30. This session is Occupational Health in Developing Countries, Acute for Social Justice. It was put together by Dr. Rima Habib, who's been organizing it from Lebanon, and she came in for this meeting. But I also wanted just to let you know that we have a really special speaker, and that's Dr. Nancy Krieger from Harvard. She's a national and an international luminary in the social determinants of health and health inequities. And she's developed an ecosocial theory of health that really includes very specifically work and the workplace. And I think you might all be really interested in learning about her theory and just hearing her speak. She's been very, very supportive of the Occupational Health and Safety section, and she's been very supportive of the Institute and our focus on social justice in the Occupational Health and Safety section and the Institute in general. So I just wanted to bring that up and encourage you to go to that session and have some interaction with Dr. Krieger. I think you'll really enjoy it. Thank you. Room number. So it's 10:30, and it's room 603. It's in the program. It's part of our program, but you might miss that detail.
Okay. Thanks, Sherry. So any other questions for any of the panelists? Tom?
California folks, you know, I live in North Carolina, and as you pointed out, we're used to seeing everybody in labor camps. And I'm just curious if you could explain a little more about what the decline of employer-sponsored housing was. Is it because the subsidies are insufficient? Is it government oversight lacking?
It's a very involved story. Eileen has been fighting on this issue for a very long time. She'll give you an answer as well. The employers say that when the OSHA regs came out, that it would be far too expensive to adjust some of the housing to comply with the OSHA regs. And there is some truth to that. There certainly was housing that was in terrible shape and that would require a considerable expense to bring up to standard. Okay, so that's one factor. There is another factor that is rarely given, I think, enough thought, and that is there is a Latinization of California that's occurred over the past couple of generations. So we have about, I would say, 40% of the state that's of Latino origin today, and communities like Arbuckle, where we went and did our study, two generations ago was a white town. It was a white farmer town. Now it's a Mexican town. And so when folks come up and find their paisanos, or people from their home village, very often they're living in rental housing, and they come and share a room with them. So that's another factor. Eileen will give the rest of the story.
Well, I do think that that regulations are a very minor part of the story, and I think that regulations of housing are often used as an excuse for employers to withdraw from the housing market when they might have been in the housing market in prior years. I think housing discrimination has a huge amount to do with it. I think the fact that they have a more exploitable workforce, which is higher in undocumented immigrants than it was in the past, is another reason. California, also different from North Carolina, has not had the history of H-2A workers, guest workers, which means that there are fewer reasons to have organized farm labor camps. There have been efforts not only in H-2A housing but in other housing to not provide organized farm labor camps that are subsidized by the government. And in shrinking economy, and shrinking government subsidy, what we find is that in the state of California, you have an Employee Housing Act which sets pretty good standards for farm labor camps and farm labor housing, but it is enforced almost in its breach, in the sense that the government has taken away almost all of the code enforcement funding from the agency that is given the task of enforcing decent, safe, and sanitary conditions. So you have two employees covering half of the state of California, and it's simply not possible to do the enforcement. And so it is honored in its breach in the sense that most of the providers of private farm labor housing, and that calling it private farm labor housing is an exaggeration in the sense that it is these old motels and it is these back houses, it's tool sheds that are being rented out, it's porches and underneath porches that are being rented out, it's space under a tarp, and people are being gouged for that, and it's easy to demand a lot of rent for that and to hide people when there's no enforcement and no incentive to enforce because you need the farm labor when the crops are coming in.
If I could add just one more comment, and that is that despite the generally catastrophic recent election, in California we've elected a Democrat governor. We have a Democrat majority in both the Assembly and the Senate. For the first time, we have all of the principal electorate institutions controlled by the Democratic Party. We tried to get an 8-hour workday last year for farm labor. As you probably know, farm labor is excluded from the overtime provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And that means that, for example, there's no overtime requirement for nearly all states except California, where in California we do have an overtime requirement for farm labor. It says after 6 consecutive 10-hour workdays, you can get overtime on the 7th day, okay, or after 10 hours of work on any day. That's what we have. We tried to get the 8-hour day last year. We got it through the legislature, both the Assembly and the Senate, vetoed by the governor. Well, we'll be back now with the new governor. Secondly, Labor put $25 million into the Jerry Brown campaign. We want the position of Secretary of Labor and Employment, which is in charge of OSHA, which is in charge of the Labor Commissioner, which is in charge of all the agencies that we think matter most to workers. We're going to get it.